Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis. How are you today?
I'm well, actually.
Yeah?
I know we didn't see each other much yesterday, so I thought I'd fill you and our listeners in on my day. I know you're all just rapt with attention. after I brushed my teeth, I went to a wine tasting, mm-hmm. German wines, which was pretty amazing. And you know, it's interesting. I'm always amazed when I have friends who aren't in the business, and they'll say, "What are you doing this afternoon?" And I'll say, "Well, I'm going to a German wine tasting from 11 to 3. And they'll say stuff like, "Have fun."
Right. Or "must be nice." And I'll tell you, they are fun. Wine tastings are a lot of fun, and you do see a lot of people that you want to see, and there's a lot of social interaction at a wine tasting. And there's a lot of work that needs to get done. We're choosing, if we're taking it seriously, and not everybody there is taking it seriously, but what I'll tell you is, of the 1,000 people that might be at a wine tasting, usually 800 of them are taking it seriously.
Well, and you know, the way it works is, and the reason that your sommelier, your restaurateur, the guy you buy your wine from in your wine shop should be going to these tastings is there's a lot out there in what's written about wines. And there are a lot of different sources for information on wines that are out there and what to buy and what not to buy and what price it should be. But the fact of the matter is, and thank heaven for this, it's still a very personal business, and everyone has a unique palate that perceives wine in a different way. What a professional does, and hopefully what Mark and I do, and our sommelier John Kafarski, what we do, is we have a consistent palate. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the same answers, you know, if you put the wines in front of me and mix them up 9 different ways or 6 months from now. But it's my own personal perspective, and we've developed a palette together as to what kind of wines we want to serve people. And the fun thing and the interesting thing when it gets to that level, and not that it sounds too, snooty about the whole thing, is that...
It's hard for you to not sound too snooty about the whole thing.
I know,
Francis.
You do it, but you do it better than I. But it's that we have an ongoing conversation, and now we've been doing this for over 15 years in New Brunswick. And there's an ongoing conversation with many of our different customers. I know what kinds of wines they like. I know mm-hmm. what kinds of wines they don't like, and I know what sort of things they might find interesting as to try something new. And I have this same long conversation. We have the same long conversation with the producers, and that's our job. And that's a lot of fun.
It is fun. And one of the reasons we go to these wine tastings is to actually taste the wines. So there's a frame of reference: this wine compared to this wine compared to this wine compared to this wine. And what we're doing when we do that is we're trying to gain a database of information so that when you ask us for something, and you don't have to use the right terminology when you come into a restaurant, you can use whatever terms you want. I want a lighter wine. I want a heavier wine. I want a wine that's going to be great with this steak. You don't have to be a professional to ask those kinds of questions.
Well, and the idea is that when we go to a wine tasting, we have a substantial investment involved. And so when you're at a professional at a wine tasting, and frankly, a lot of these are available, and we know a lot of restaurateurs listen to the show on the internet, there are two ways to buy wine. It used to be that your salesman would show up with samples for you, or you would buy based on what you read in a magazine. Well, you know, that's not the way to get the best selection or to be as intimately acquainted with not only what you wind up buying, but the wines you elect not to buy.
Well, and it's not the best way to get the wines that you like. It's not because what Francis said earlier is wine is a matter of personal taste. So if you can come up with some descriptors for the types of wine you like, hopefully the person who works in the shop or the restaurant that you're in can match those descriptors. I don't want to just sell you the wines that I love. I want to sell you the wines you're going to love.
Well, and the other thing is, I think what I think is a difficult and a wonderful thing to do is we need a frame of reference. And when I talk about knowing the wines that you didn't buy, yesterday I tasted about 195 Rieslings from Germany,
mm-hmm.
from 2005, 2006, and 2007 mostly. I have a pretty clear idea of the vintage because I'll have two more German wine tastings like that before the year is out.
Sure, plus random tastings here and there, 10, 15 bottles of that.
So we may, you know, have on our wine list maybe 35 German wines. We have a pretty big wine list. We have about 900 selections left. So maybe we have 35 wines from the current set of vintages. But when you talk to me or John, our sommelier who was there, or to Mark, we can talk intelligently about those wines that we have, and in the context, we can talk about the wine in general and where it fits in, and that's really an important thing, and it's a wonderful thing about doing business in and around New York, because very often people who are, say, studying for their degrees in wine, if you're in Wisconsin, you have a harder time of it because you don't mm-hmm. have those tastings to go to and that frame of reference to go to.
And listen, there are a lot of different ways to write a wine list. I'm not going to tell you that every restaurant owner, every shopkeeper is tasting all these wines and going to these tastings and tasting 10,000 wines a year.
But that's the best way to do it.
If you're a professional, that's the best way to do it. That's how you get your frame of reference. But I will tell you that I know people in restaurants maybe where they don't focus so much on their wine list, where they just say, okay, send me whatever and fill out my – I need a Cabernet for $50 a bottle.
Send me one. Well, and that wine salesman is not going to send you the best Cabernet because mm-hmm. he's got to save that for a client who really knows the difference and cares.
Who cares?
Right. Well, you know, what's funny, though, is people talk about wine people. And there was – what's interesting is everyone at that wine tasting, sober as a judge. Mm-hmm. Tasting wines for 5 hours, not a single person – showed the slightest sign of inebriation, and that's the way it works.
Right.
Now,
well, most of us have to go back to work too. So.
Right. Well, the thing is, though, but among the producers and the professionals there, and then the buyers there, yes, I mean the wine tasting went on for basically from 11 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. 4 in the afternoon, not a single person showed the slightest sign of inebriation.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into those people around 11 p.m., however. And the ones who had elected to go out.
That was after the martini tasting, though, so things changed.
You can really party like rock stars. But, and the other thing is, it's a big investment. So when you go to a restaurant that has a great wine list, it's an investment of time for that restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's an investment of money for that restaurant. I mean,
sure.
I took the day off from work yesterday.
Sure. Not to mention the inventory that you talk about.
For a restaurant to invest a couple hundred thousand dollars, at least, to have an amazing wine list, that's a pretty substantial thing, and that's why I think people are. But it's all got to be there to feed a passion. It's all got to be there so that when you come in, whether you know a lot about wine, there's something there that's great for you, or if you really don't know very much about wine at all, and say, okay, what about this wine stuff? I want a white and I want it slightly sweet. There should be somebody there who knows something and can. You know, it's like evangelizing about wine, as it were, you know? Well, we're going to talk after the break with a gentleman named Josh Ozersky, and he is the in charge of the food blog at New York Magazine. And if you're not in the blogosphere, it's an amazing world. This food blog is updated several times a day, and it's one of the richest sources of information on food you'll find. We'll be talking with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Josh Ozersky. He has written several books, but he's also the online food editor for New York Magazine's food blog called Grub Street.
Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, what's going on?
Josh, basically you're blogging like 10, 15 times a day. Where'd you find an hour to do our show?
It's hard to say. You know, even at the very moment, I have hooks in me in every direction.
I better not hear you typing in the background.
I can't make any promises.
All right. Now, we should explain to all of our listeners, most of you know what blogging is all about, but a blog is a news post that's updated several times a day. New York Magazine has long been one of the greatest sources for food news in one of the most important food cities in the world, which is New York. And Josh heads up this food blog, which is completely addictive if you're into the New York food scene. Josh, I really don't have time to read it all. Why? And I keep, like, going back on my desk.
I don't even have time to read it all.
So talk to us about how writing a blog has first of all, is becoming much more important. My fiancé and I email back stuff from your blog to each other all the time, like, you want to try this? Did you see that? Check this out. But you're in there several times a day. How does the style of writing differ, and how does the lifestyle of a blogger differ from writing for a print publication?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. For one thing, I should clarify, I don't do Grub Street by myself. There's another guy, Daniel Maurer, who does a fantastic job for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of sort of split a little bit. He's sort of a little bit more on the nightlife and cocktail side of things, and I'm a little bit more on the food. But, you know, we're both constantly working, you know, inexhaustibly round the clock to keep Grub Street fed. And, you know, the thing about a blog is that we are on basically an hourly news cycle. I mean, the people who are writing for a magazine or a newspaper or a monthly magazine, you know, they have days and days to do, you know, go around and figure things out and rewrite and so forth. But then they have to wait before the news can come out. So generally they get scooped by us because as soon as we get news, it gets written and it gets reported and written and edited and put right up. And that basically means that we have an unusual situation as writers, which is that we're basically writing in real time. I mean, what you read on Grub Street frequently has been written and reported and learned about within an hour or two.
But doesn't that make it a lot more difficult to do things like fact-checking? I mean, that the things you write live on your website forever.
Well, that's right, and that's why we have to be very careful about that. But, you know, also, I mean, these are not long posts. You know, basically we just get right to the heart of the matter. And, you know, I mean, and that is we've been pretty solid. I mean, we haven't really gone too far wrong. The other thing, too, is that there's such a need for content that it's not all news. We also do these cool service features. You know, we do, like, I went all around the city on the subway finding good places near subway lines. We do the annotated dish. We have the New York diet where we interview celebrities and ask them what they ate that week. So there's, like, a ton of cool stuff. And somehow it all comes out, and it all comes out good.
You know what I think is fabulous in looking at this? And one of the things, and I've read this column for years because I subscribe to New York Magazine, and I read the column. And we've stolen some show ideas from you. Thank you for those, by the way. But what I find is really fascinating to me is when I look at it in context, so I look through a week's blog at a time, I realize how many people are paying such close attention. You'll often post something on Grub Street, and then there'll be a response from the owner or the chef or the restaurateur within hours.
Yeah.
To offer insight or a correction or a response, which means that a lot of people are reading this all the time.
Yeah, a lot of people are reading it all the time, and you can assume that everyone in the business is reading it. So it sort of casts us in an interesting place that we are sort of like the nerve center, as it were, of the restaurant business in New York, and to an extent, you know, maybe worldwide insofar as New York chefs have, you know, effects in other big cities, which they do.
I think that's certainly true. And by the way, when you're listening, you can go to the New York Magazine's website. It's nymag.com/daily/food, and you can find, or you can just look up Josh Zersky or link to it through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. You also, online, you can be a little less formal and engage in a little more gossip, which is a lot of fun. Are there fewer restraints on the type of content that you can put up on the web?
Well, we are restrained because while we're a blog and there's certain formal aspects of the medium that, you know, are liberating. On the other hand, we are part of New York Magazine, so we can't just say any kind of crazy thing that comes into our heads or, you know, kind of salaciously spread gossip or whatever. I mean, there's you know, a certain code of what we want to do that is appropriate for New York Magazine's online presence.
Well, you know, we're going to take a quick break, Josh, and stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Josh Ozersky, about the editor of the online food blog for New York Magazine, Grub Street. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The Place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or catherinelombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and we're talking with Josh Ozersky, who's the editor for New York Magazine's blog, Grub Street. You know, okay, so here's we were talking about stuff that you mightn't see in the magazine, that you do see on the blog, that for those of us who are interested in the food world is fascinating and fun. On today's blog, you have the bit about Rachel Ray.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
That's something I was thinking of while you guys were on break. Because, you know, in the magazine, the amount of ink you can put on the paper is very precious. There's only so many pages, and there's ads and everything else. But you can put as much as you want on a blog, and something like this that's slight but incredibly amusing, you know, we can put up right away.
You need to share, Josh.
Well, somebody wrote into Grub Street, and you know, and we say basically, you know, we have a feature called the inbox where people write us letters and so forth. And he told us a story that Rachel Ray was filming a Dunkin' Donuts commercial. And she took one sip of her. I'm quoting the. What is it? She took one sip of her Dunkin' Donuts coffee and yelled, "What is this blank? Get me my coffee!" And wouldn't continue until she was given her coffee, i.e., Starbucks.
Ouch.
But let me flesh that out a little bit. What you're able to print online that you probably wouldn't see in the print magazine is you printed the guy's letter, which is so. A friend of mine was on the set last week as Rachel Ray filmed her latest Dunkin' Donuts commercial. According to her, Rachel stormed onto the set and snapped at everyone. Not news, really. Everyone knows she's actually a gigantic something. And then at the end, where you talk about how she doesn't take the Dunkin' Donuts coffee, the Grub Street writes, "This is the first thing we've read that makes us like Rachel Ray." We love you guys, you see? But you wouldn't do that in a print publication, right? It wouldn't fit in the seriousness of the magazine, but if you're updating every couple of hours, it's like an ongoing story that never ends.
It's a conversation.
Not only that, too, but it's interactive, too. This went up at 11. Already someone has written in a comment. They wrote, Dunkin' Donuts coffee rules. I resent this.
And already somebody's talking about it on the radio.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what? If we look at the media world, and I do want to take sort of a broader look after we come back from the news, but one of the things that I like about the online publication is you have a section where you write about other food publications and other critics. That's pretty cool take on things.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I just got done writing it. That particular rubric we call the other critics. I just got done doing that. Well, the thing with Grub Street is this: we want Grub Street to be the one spot destination for anybody that's interested in the food or restaurant business. So. Sure, we have all of our own amazing original content, which is better and more interesting and funnier than everybody else's. But also, you can find out about anything else that's happening. We'll link to anything that's news, so you can basically go to Grub Street and not just find our stuff, but links and pointers to all the other good stuff. Every morning we have Media War, which is the 12 or 13 best things.
We're going to take a break and listen to the news. We're going to come back and talk more with Josh Ozersky about Grub Street, the online blog for New York Magazine. Back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Josh Ozersky. He's the editor of New York Magazine's food blog, Grub Street, one of our favorite things to read. You can link yourself to it by going to restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll put a link up there. And I warn you, when you start, it's very addictive. You'll go back three times a day, and your boss may fire you.
Josh, is there too much information out there on the blogosphere right now? Is it too hard to navigate what's out there and what's right and what's just a bunch of bunk?
I mean, you know, it's always going to be a problem separating the wheat from the chaff. I think that really there's probably, you know, there's three or four good restaurant online restaurant sources. I think, you know, We're Good. I think that Food and Wine's blog is good. I think that Eater is good, you know, and I think we're, you know, I don't know who's the most reliable. I think we are, you know, obviously, but all have a lot of entertainment value, and no one or two people could possibly capture everything that's going on. I mean, think about how many restaurants there are in New York and how many chefs and how many celebrity chefs and all the stuff that goes on in terms of food news and, you know, sushi and mercury and, you know, sustainable trees or God knows what else, you know?
So remember, the online place to read about the food world would be Grub Street, and to listen to the food world would be restaurantguysradio.com.
Absolutely. And remember, it's not grubstreet.com. You have to go to nymag.com and then we're the food section on there, on that.
Right, or if you can go nymag.com and hit /daily/food and you'll find it. Now, let's talk about some juicy dish that's come out recently. You're covering a breaking story now. It seems as though some food critic left their notebook behind in a
restaurant. Yes, the case of the missing notebook.
Let's talk about that. Bring us up to speed here.
Well, essentially what happened is this. There is a new restaurant called Brasserie 44 in Midtown, which is a pretty ambitious restaurant and wants to have good reviews. And somebody left a notebook with detailed notes in it about the food. Now, this happened last week, and the person came and picked it up already, so no one has actually seen the notebook, which only adds to the allure of the story. And we have written about it, and our various rivals have written about it, and we're not done with it yet, because we still can't figure out who left this notebook. Frank Bruni from the Times has denied it. They thought it was restaurant girl Danielle Freeman, the critic for the New York Daily News. She denied it. I know it wasn't Adam Platt, our critic, because he writes on little scraps of paper and candy bar.
the back of his hand. Hard to leave that behind.
So until we get to the bottom of this, you know, I mean, it's like we're going to have to start collecting cell phone buzz, or what do they call when they have the Al-Qaeda cell phone chatter? Uh-huh. We're going to have to use NSA security resources to
intercept
the
chatter on that. But the book was picked up, and they didn't betray who it was that had left it behind?
They didn't know. I talked to the owner of the restaurant, and it's a guy named John McDonald, and he had never even seen it. Somebody left it. Somebody on the staff said that there was a notebook. They left it at the front desk. Somebody came and picked it up in the morning. So, I mean, but somebody who had seen it or said that they knew somebody who had seen it wrote in to somewhere else. It didn't start with us, but we are determined to do more and better coverage of the notebook affair than any other food source you can name.
But, you know, in this day and age, it could have been left behind by basically any Tom, Dick, and Harry who fashions himself a food critic who's going to put up a food review on his MySpace page.
And there's no shortage of them. They go around with the digital camera. They shoot what they have for dinner, and then they write about it.
Oh, believe me, we know.
you know, it's funny. What I would have done as a restaurateur, if I had that notebook, is I would have placed it on the counter And then I would have, much like I trapped rabbits when I was a child, set up a large box with a string where I pulled the string and the box would fall down on whoever that was.
Well, then they would have blocked from inside the box.
Now,
I want to talk about this for 1 second. You own a restaurant. And you see, you know, we're talking about all these people who are doing their own little reviews on MySpace or whatever, or posting things on one website or another. And basically, and I had a discussion, Francis and I had a discussion with Audrey Saunders from Pegu Club that was pretty similar to this. You know, I had to ask somebody to leave the restaurant within the last month or so. Now, I knew that sometime in the next 48 hours that this person who was so rude I had to ask them to leave was going to be posting on some website or another.
And they did.
The travail of you know.
And they did. And they called Mark.
Of being so rude they had to be thrown out.
But I think that there's so much out there that, I mean, again, it's separating the wheat from the chaff, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, you know. But, I mean, I do think, though, that I'm not on the side of the restaurateurs who think that all the bloggers should be banned. I mean,
no.
I think that a lot of the bloggers, I mean, certainly by taking a picture, they give you a kind of an objective view.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always felt that if I can look at a menu and see what the food likes, I have 90% of the knowledge that I need to decide whether I want to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can almost skim over what they have to say about it.
Mm.
It's only when they really get into slinging around invective. I mean, that's where they're most loathsome. I mean, sometimes in the comments page on some of the other sites, people just let fly stuff. Somebody wrote the other day about me. They said, what's the difference between cutlets and Captain Lou Albano? Not much.
Mm.
Now, that stings.
Cutlets being your nickname for our listeners. Well, now,
you don't rubber band your goatee, do you?
No, it's not long enough.
Now, let's talk about one of the other cool things that you do on your website. It's you play the 2 for 8 game at about 4:30 p.m. every day. What's that about?
Yeah, once in a while.
Well, that's a feature we do that's very useful and actually one of our most popular things. We have somebody call up 10 very hot and in-demand type restaurants, a different 10 every day, and they call up at 3 and they say, I need a table for 2 tonight at 8 o'clock. What can you do for me? So at 4 o'clock, we publish it, and you can basically see who has a table, who doesn't have a table, who's booked up. And if you move fast, you might be able to get one at a place you wouldn't normally be able to get into.
Now, where in all this do you have time to go out to dinner?
At night. I go out every night.
Really? Do you yourself decide based on your experiences at night where you're going to be covering things and what you're going to be looking at? Or is it driven by your readers and your online contributors? Where does the direction come from?
I kind of see myself sort of as the Walter Winchell of the restaurant business. But the difference between me and Winchell is that he sat at table 50 in the Stork Club and everybody came up and told him stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I bop around to 2 or 3 different places a night trying to see what's going on, talk to people, hear what the buzz is, you know, and basically pick up whatever gossip or news I can, and then follow up with it with, you know, legitimate sources and so forth the next day.
I am amazed about how much buzz there really is, because there is always something going on. There's always something being talked about.
Well, I mean, look at it. I mean, if you look at the difference in restaurants now between 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I mean, every month there's major restaurants opening up. I mean, sure, some close, but the amount of talent, the amount of effort, the amount of money, the complexity of the food, the genius of the chefs, I mean, the speed and of the trends that are coming and going, I mean, it would stymie a Winchell and it would stymie a Craig Claiborne if he were around. There's not enough. No one man could possibly handle it all, so we're just doing our Atlas routine as best we can.
I think it's an interesting part of society where we are more concerned with food now. And in a city like New York where, you know, it's one of the polite things to talk about. It's like sports and food are the two topics of conversation that almost everybody has in common.
Yeah, and except for the Giants, it's a lot more cheerful to talk about the food. You know?
I completely understand. When I come back, I want to talk about things like reporting on when a restaurant's having difficulty or the death watch of restaurants. I think that's an interesting topic to broach.
And we better talk for a minute or two about cheeseburgers.
Oh,
too.
Absolutely. We'll be back,
that's my favorite subject.
We'll be back in just a moment. And Josh is also one of the world's great experts on cheeseburgers, and we'll learn more about that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1145.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, here with you talking with Josh Zersky from New York Magazine's online food blog, Grub Street. You know, one of the things that I think is really fascinating if you're following the openings and closings of restaurants in New York is when restaurants have trouble, there's one restaurant that you've covered a number of times and just recently, it's a bar called Death & Company.
Right.
And they seem to be getting, having a lot of trouble with the neighbors in the neighborhood. And I've been to that bar 10 times, and I think it's a very civilized, quiet place. Why are they having such trouble?
Well, the problem is that the neighbors are insane. See, the East Village, the situation, and really the expert on this is Daniel. He's really the one who broke that Death & Company story and all the stories about the nightclubs and cocktail lounges. But essentially, it's a highly political pressure cooker where if you want to get a liquor license from the state liquor authority, you need approval from the community board. And the community board is decisive, and the East Village has turned into such a hotbed of bars and cocktail lounges, and the people who live there are such crackpots that, you know, you're completely vulnerable to their caprices, even if you have a very quiet, low-key operation.
But this is a quiet, low-key operation that, from what I understand, got approval from the community board. Now they're open and they want to shut them down?
Well, basically, you know, if they complain, you know, there can be problems. I mean, what I can actually do is, it's a good question. You know what? I'm going to ask Daniel right now. Daniel, they got state liquor license approval. How can the community board give them trouble now? Because it's up for renewal.
Okay.
I see.
And you can get all this from reading the Grub Street Post on our subject. Just go to our site and do a search for Death & Company.
The bar is called Death & Company. One final question about Death & Company and a lot of other of these cocktail bars is there seems to be a penchant, and I know you've covered this a lot on Grub Street, for like the secret bar or the underground restaurant that's hard to find, yet they publish themselves on MySpace so they can find them. What's that issue about?
Well, you know, I mean, New Yorkers are constantly striving for status, you know, as Tom Wolfe and everybody else always observed. And, you know, it really brings an extra cachet if you can get into a place that the regular visitor from Hohokus doesn't know about. And, you know, the great example of that is Milk and Honey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sasha's place.
I mean, Milk and Honey is you know, still sort of the gold standard for cocktail lounges. And we actually, when they changed their number, did a contest asking who could write the most pathetic, heart-wrenching, desperate letter, you know, to try to get for the number of Milk and Honey.
Let me explain to our listeners what Milk and Honey is all about. Milk and Honey is a very small little cocktail bar behind an unmarked door downtown, and they have a number that's non-published. And if you want to get into Milk and Honey, you've got to have the number and call and make a reservation. And if they get too busy, they change the number. And it seems to be counterintuitive, yet that's the spot where everyone wants
works,
to be.
It works, though. It's packed every time I go.
Oh, forget about it. 100 people wrote in, and the things that they said, I mean, it was like, it was worse than the March of Dimes telethon. You know?
I always feel like Superman, though, whenever I get to go through a telephone booth to get into a cocktail bar.
Well, there actually is, believe it or not, there actually is a place where you go through a telephone booth to get into a cocktail bar.
Mm-hmm.
It's PDT down on St. Mark's Place, which is actually my favorite cocktail lounge. And it's that guy Jim Meehan.
It's a great place. Jim's a good guy.
Cocktails at Gramercy.
Yeah, Jim's actually been on the show, and I have to say I do love the bar, and it does feed into that, like, I feel like I'm going into a secret place. But don't you always feel a little bit stupid when you stand in that telephone booth?
No.
I mean, don't you, just the way to get in, doesn't that make you feel a little ooky?
No, it gives me a little frisson of excitement.
Yeah, I told you. I get in my Superman garb, and off I go.
Well, let's talk burgers for a moment or two.
You know, I have a book coming out in a couple of months, A History of the Hamburger in America.
I know. This is the planned plug for the book.
I'm just establishing my bona fides.
Excellent. So, yeah, so the burger comes out in April, and you talk – is it really a history of the hamburger or just a survey of where to get a great hamburger?
No. Somebody else can write the survey. In fact, somebody did. There's a book coming out called Hamburger America by George Motes, and that's that book. My book is like a thrilling saga of the history of the hamburger in America and how it took over the world. But it's written with a deep relish and a kind of a maniacal analytic intensity about the hamburger business and the great men of the hamburger world and what makes hamburgers important and why I love them and
so
why
was,
they matter.
Was relish your little play on the hamburger world?
Yeah, God, that it should have been.
Now you talk about the origins of like where the hamburger was created and where it came from, or just the history of the business in America?
No, all of it. From its origin, from cradle to grave, although there is no grave.
There's no way. Are you kidding? It's the most popular thing on the planet.
It's putting us in our graves maybe a little bit sooner than we'd like. But it's so. Let me ask. In we only have about a minute left. But can you give us your top hamburger spots in New York or in the country?
Yeah, my favorite hamburger spot in New York, actually, I'm not saying it's the best, but my favorite is a place called Veselka on 2nd Avenue and 9th Street. The bacon cheeseburger at Veselka is, to my mind, the perfect hamburger experience.
I used to live right there. I had many of those in the wee hours of the morning.
Among the sort of the elite hamburger high-end places, I don't think it gets much better than the Spotted Pig or City Hall. Or borrow food and drink, although I disapprove of the Spotted Pig putting Roquefort cheese. I believe in American cheese.
So you must feel that the basic French meatloaf on a bun that people are calling hamburgers is...
No, that's horrific. It's grotesque. When I see a fist-shaped hamburger, it makes me want to run for the hills.
Yeah, I'm
totally with you there. That's a different animal. It's a totally different thing than a hamburger. Don't call it a hamburger.
Disc or bust. That's my attitude.
I'm in. Well, Josh, I'm afraid we need to leave it there, but it's been wonderful to have you on the show. Thanks for coming to talk with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Josh, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, guys.
You're welcome. You can find out more about Josh Ozersky on New York Magazine's website, nymag.com. Check out their food blog. You can link to them, of course, through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Mark and I will be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis.
Interesting intro, Francis.
Yeah, I got to mix it up every once in a while.
I was talking earlier with Josh about, you know, French meatloaf on a bun that seems to be popular to call a hamburger. I don't have any problem with a short rib sandwich. I don't even have any problem with, some of the pâtés on a bun that have come out and kind of become out there as gourmet hamburgers, but they're not hamburgers.
I don't think the listeners know what you're talking about. Well, there are a number of places in New York, many run by French chefs, who have started selling very expensive hamburgers. There was Café Boulud, which is a restaurant run by Daniel Boulud, started serving a hamburger. Was at that time the most expensive hamburger in New York. Well, I've had it, and it's not a hamburger. It's a loose interpretation of a hamburger. It's pulled meat, it's formed, and I've had it, and it's delicious.
Right.
But it's just not a hamburger.
But it's not the same thing.
A hamburger's ground beef with spices, maybe. Maybe you want to throw some onions on top of it, you can. But that's what a hamburger is. But that the Blue thing, one thing I do congratulate the places for that are coming out with these very expensive hamburgers is they're justifying the expense by putting these expensive ingredients into the hamburger.
Sure.
Whereas for a long time in the city of New York, it was the 21 Club had the most expensive hamburger through the 80s and into the 90s. And then a restaurant called Patroon opened and charged $5 more because they wanted the most – because they wanted to be known as the place. And there was no reason for it. It was just because you had some status by spending
They were really good hamburgers.
But $35 for a hamburger.
But they were pretty expensive.
$19.97 doesn't quite cut it. Anyway, if you want the best hamburger in New Jersey, you could come to Stage Left and have one at the bar. That's my, sorry, I have to have a little plug in there, but
that's
it's just the truth. Anyway, I hope that you've enjoyed this hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. If you want to check out more about New York Magazine, it's an amazing, amazing resource for all sorts of food knowledge, both serious and fun. And you can link to that through restaurantguysradio.com. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.